하나라는게 그
function of the Human Rights Commission exercise. time over the regulator. Clearly there could be, one doesn't want to have a battle of a turf battle again. Remain bearing in mind the Cato Asthma Report spoke about an overarching new structure. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The first one is a request for you, Mr. Chairman, if obviously an outstanding one, if the presenter would not mind at a later time send us a little draft of the type of power that she was referring to, that she would like to see in the list of functions and powers of the regulator, so with the actual language we can apply our mind to the details of her submission. I have a number of questions, and I will present the same questions to some of the two different presenters, just to put my mind around the issue. And to this presenter, with your permission, Mr. Chairman, I just want to engage on one issue that she raised: the exception for the state, basically for the throughout the bill, there are a number of exemptions which exempt the activity when required by law. I have a conceptual problem of exempting an entity rather than an activity. The activity is identified because it's required by law and is protected by another law requiring that activity to be conducted. Exempting the state, and especially the state in terms of national security, defense, and public safety, which actors on the noble demeanor as compared to one another, it seems to be an exemption much larger than the rule. Historically, the greater violations of human rights come from the state and not from the private sector. So I just want to be assisted in putting my mind around this issue.
Possibly no institution, possibly no person has paid so much attention and lavished so much care upon the PAYA as Ms. Allison Tilley and her organization. And I would like to say that I therefore particularly value your input. And I also thought it was characterized by great charm, so never mind any spell check omission, which I incidentally didn't pick up. I thought it was a charming submission, and like Dr. Albrecini, I would love to see much, much more, since you really know the field. Especially in respect of the dual functions of the regulator. This bill has taken the debate into a whole different scenario since we were last looking at the possibility of establishing the information regulator within the Human Rights Commission, or slightly outside, but at a cost of what was then positive to be what is 7 million, whereas here 17 million is required just to establish. And I am very sympathetic to the idea that, or increasingly so, that this regulator, whatever we call it, the rose by any other name, willing as we, whatever we call it, should in fact look after the fire and this new function, because it is true what you say. What you argue that the fire is not working, that is so, and we need to do something about it. Now, just a specific question on such a regulator. You propose cost recovery as a funding mechanism. But let me say this to you. It is my understanding that the rights of privacy that we are here protecting are those of natural persons in the first place. And it is because of technology and the increased use of electronic databases, surely that a whole new form, a species of intrusion into privacy has arisen in our time over the last decade or two. And surely that is what we're dealing with. And half the reason for this legislation is that for the average person to defend their privacy by going to court is simply too expensive, it's not realistic. To me, this is the real reason for this legislation. Now, if that being the case, and hopefully even if the jurisdictions remain in, we will see, what kind of cost recovery are you going to be able to muster on the basis of the complaints of individual natural persons? That to me is a problem. And the second question, because I think we will want to see you again later when we talk about the regulator and its function, especially after your Canadian excursion. Just on the matter of the journalists, I think that we must, as early as possible in these proceedings, exclude the whole field of journalism. I think we're talking about electronic data banks. the kinds that are booked for commercial purposes. And I think we're going to run into endless difficulty if we try to apply this legislation to the work of journalists. They have come into conflict with the constitutional right of privacy and the common law. In the field of dignity, reputation, and pharma, and there is by now a well-developed corpus of judgment of law on that matter, whereas I think we're dealing with something else here. And so I'm really asking for your response. Surely we're dealing with data banks. Surely journalism shouldn't come in here at all. And isn't that a cleaner way to cut at the problem that you yourself also identify?
My first point is just the extension of the powers of the regulator. I mean, it really is the Promotion of Access to Information Act that you're wanting amended rather than insertions into this one. I know that this one does amend PIA, but not that substantially. And I think the difficulty of considering that now is that would be a whole entire new area. I mean, I hear what you're saying, and I know there are problems with the implementation of PIA, but I don't know if we can do that now. Parliament has reviewed, for example, the equality legislation. It may be useful for Parliament to do a review of PIA and how it's working. But to simply sort of tack in a extension to the powers of the regulator as far as access to information into a bill dealing with privacy, I think would be very difficult and would require far greater consultation. So that's a sort of one comment. So for me, the sort of points we're raising are really in the last two pages, effectively, of your submission, which you listed. The issue of juristic persons, there's quite an extensive discussion in the Law Commission report. You read that. It would have been useful to go through that Law Commission report and say more specifically where you disagree, because maybe because of time or whatever, you've just given us a paragraph on quite a crucial and quite an essential issue. And the same really goes for the other ones. I mean, I know your main interest was PIA and improving the enforceability of PIA, but the difficulty is if we're not able to deal with that now, which I personally feel we're not. The other submissions you've made are very brief, and it may be useful to give us more substantial more substantial arguments on those. Chair, that's all.
And then, Chairperson, could you elaborate a little further on your concerns about the 30-day limit for appeals?
Thank you, sir. On the first question about the location of the regulator, there is, I suppose, the argument really flows in most part from the way the EU directive is set up on data protection, because if we're going to take our guide from that, and it's helpful too, because it means that then we meet the EU data protection standards, which means that they can then transfer data to us, which means advanced passenger information can come our way, which means we can get the World Cup right. Everything comes back to football. It's clear from the EU data protection directive that you need a separate structure. You need an enforcement body. Once you have an enforcement body dealing with privacy, the question is then logically, why do you then not have a body dealing with privacy and access to information? Because that is the international trend. I would say that in most jurisdictions where they've established a regulator more recently, the United Kingdom is an example, they put the two agencies together for a very good reason, because you're trying to weigh two rights. And it's a sensible reasonable idea to put them in one place. The experience of people who do this seems to be that it is then easier to weigh up what is should be released and what should not be released and should be considered private. Where you have two regulators, you can end up in a situation where you get a distance between the two. That's particularly the Canadian federal experience and interestingly enough, the Swedish experience, where you have agencies pulling in different directions, which is unhelpful. So also to say that in access to information terms, a inexpensive, quick place where you can go and get a remedy is obviously part of the structure that you need for implementation of that right. It's something that this committee originally, when it dealt with the Access to Information Act, referred to the Department of Justice for more investigation of. We've never had a report from the Department of Justice on this particular issue, but it was seen then as crucial. I would argue that it is crucial now. As to whether the Human Rights Commission has developed a practice around access to information. They believe in it. They would like to promote it. They would like to support it. I would feel very badly about taking it away from them entirely, simply because there are so few champions out there. And we really do want to encourage institutions to be champions. But I think that's not going as far as saying that I think that they should retain all of the promotional powers. I think what that means is that we shouldn't perhaps adopt the approach that if access to information is to be dealt with by the regulator, then the Human Rights Commission does not deal with it at all. I don't see why there's a reason to do that. I think that there should be champions in all sorts of places in government, and I think there are. Public Service Commission is one. They regularly look at the issue of access to information. That's, you know, the Department of Public Services Administration again. So there is clearly a need for a separate structure with order powers dealing with privacy and access to information. Whether practically you put it in a floor in the building, the Human Rights Commission building, and you run this, you know, use the same payroll system, that's another question. But there must be a separate structure, we would argue. Mr. Ambrosini and Mr. Jeffries Mr. Jeffries is suggesting that order powers are perhaps not something that this committee can deal with, but I would suggest that they are actually quite easily dealt with. Certainly the Ontario legislation deals with the order powers quite briefly, and it's a section of a page, no more. There's some question about how much detail you would put in and how much you could leave for regulations, but it does seem to me that if you are going to create the structure, there is no reason to not to take that final step and to put those powers in. It can be held off for another day. The committee is seized with this issue. It's in front of you. It's possible for you to do it. It's long overdue. You know, to wait for another opportunity. There may be one, but you know, when that is, we don't know. On the question of the issue of journalists being excluded. I think the exclusion of journalists is correct. I think that it's a balancing of other rights, like the right to freedom of expression, the right of the media. So I think that excluding them is correct, but I think that there are issues where, as I suggested, where journalists are given personal data, and there need to be exclusions around it. I would suggest specific exclusions around that process in the case of whistleblowing. question of juristic persons, it is difficult to go into more detail than the Law Reform Commission has. I think it's more of a policy decision. I think there is an argument to be made that juristic persons have a right to privacy. That right to privacy is obviously not the same as natural persons. And I think that it's going to be quite complicated for, particularly for officials, to apply that section where I think it says to the extent necessary, or there's language of that sort there in that section. And I think it's very difficult. I think it's going to be very difficult for a bureaucrat to look at that and know what that means. And I think you're going to have to give them more guidance on that, on what that means, or exclude juristic persons, which is entirely possible and is done in many jurisdictions. There's no rule that says that we, you know, absolutely have to have juristic persons dealt with in this legislation. So on the question of 30-day limits, the as I understand the section talks about making application to court within 30 days. And the problem is that that's exactly what the Access to Information Act says, is that you can make application to court in 30 days. And the judgment handed down by now our Chief Justice, Judge Norbert, gives us a clear picture of why that is a problem. Because people take time to get their resources together. It takes time to make a decision to litigate. It takes time to get an attorney. And the less advantaged you are, the more time it takes. So, yes, if you are in the city and you have a lawyer and you have money, it's all probably possible. But what the court held in that decision was that that it really disadvantaged people, and therefore it was an infringement of the right, and the right of access to justice as well, I guess. And they said, well, it will give you 180 days in the meantime, and then actually referred it back to the committee to look at saying which of the 180 days will stand. So the court's given us an indication that 180 days is something that they think is a good time period. They weren't saying that that's what this committee had to do at all, as far as I understand, that this committee would consider it and be able to make a different decision. But that certainly the 30 days was far too short a time for people to be able to really mobilize the kinds of resources that they need, especially living further away from the courts, as many of our communities do. So I think that was the thing on this issue.
Another one, I don't want to get into a debate on it, and it's something the committee would need to discuss, but. You know, yes, we can amend PIRE in this bill, and this bill does amend other aspects of PIRE, but you would appreciate, if you look at the long title, that this bill is doing something else. What you're proposing is something entirely new, and that has ramifications in terms of consultation, et cetera, et cetera. So it's not as easy as we can do it, but it's not as easy as you make out, and I would still urge that you look at an overall review of PIRE.
Thank you very much. We move into the next input.
My name is Konrad Matenet. I head the Business Unity South Africa's Parliamentary Office. It's a newly established office to facilitate.
You have 40 minutes.
Yes.
Oh, 2020 for presentation?
I'll get to that in just a second. We facilitate interaction between Business Unity South Africa in particular, which includes representation of small business and organized business in general with Parliament. Our office is on Church Square for the information of the members. It is easy to get a hold of us if you want to have contact with organized business. Our time other allocation that we received last week seems to have been much more generous than what's allocated today on the business program. We expect our presentations, the two together, to run for about 25 minutes. Chair, with your leniency, we'll try and stick to as close as possible to what's been allocated for us today. The two delegations that we have here today, one is from Business Unity South Africa, represented by Timmy Suisa and Kirsten Ellis. And then we've got a delegation from the Association for Savings and Investment South Africa. The presentation is going to be made by Ms. Johan Daly, which sits behind me on my right-hand side. And you will be assisted during question time by Rosemary Lightbody and Hanneke Petra. Simi will commence with a high-level presentation of a couple of minutes, and that will be followed by a more technical presentation by CISA.
According to the introduction,
yeah. So are you? So are they getting 20 minutes each? Is that the understanding? Or?
I think we are going to try and get them to present in 20 minutes.
I noticed that
we can give them 5 minutes more.
I see someone has pulled out afterwards, so there does seem to be a bit of time. Thank you, Judy.
Yeah, then I will can give them 5 minutes.
If I may, the initial indication that we received was for 40 minutes, but we will, I'm pretty sure, be very close to 20 minutes.
Thank you very much. Business people are always business-like, so I'm hoping we'll be able to do that. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. On behalf of Business Unity South Africa, I would like to thank you and the committee for the opportunity to make some remarks on the PPI bill. Our presentation will focus on high-level issues, and that is because two of our members, AFISA and the Banking Association, will be making technical submissions on the bill. In general, AFISA welcomes the introduction of PPI legislation in South Africa. We believe that this is very useful, and it will enhance the competitiveness of South African business by providing a clear framework for us to manage data. This is particularly important because the majority of our trading partners have already implemented similar legislation. However, Honourable Chairperson, we have some minor concerns that we would like to raise. Our first concern is around the consultation period leading up to the parliamentary process. We appreciate that the Law Reform Commission initiated the public consultations as early as 2007. However, the department did not table the bill at NEDLAC as we had requested. Now, our understanding is that the NEDLAC Act allows for a situation whereby if the NEDLAC constituencies request for a bill to be tabled, the government department responsible would have an obligation to table such bill. Additionally, we also concerned that the time given for constituencies and submissions of public input during the parliamentary process was inadequate. In most cases, we failed to solicit adequate responses from our members, and we believe that a longer public consultation process could have enriched the discussion on PPI. Secondly, Honourable Chairperson, also I'm concerned that the department failed to implement an RIA on this bill. The regulatory impact assessment is recognized as an important instrument in reducing the cost of legislation on the private sector. In 2007, the South African government adopted the RIA framework in recognition of its importance in ensuring that the regulatory burden on business is reduced. We are very disappointed to know that there has been limited progress across all departments in implementing the RIA framework. It is particularly important given the fact that in the next 18 months, business will be expected to implement not less than three legislations: the Consumer Protection Act, the Companies Act, and finally the PPI Bill, which will become a PPI Act once passed. Whilst we haven't done a thorough regulatory impact assessment, anecdotal evidence coming from our members suggests that the cost of implementing such legislation could be in excess of 2 billion rand. And as the committee might appreciate, these are significant resources given the current economic crisis and the pressure faced by business. In this regard, we would propose that some of the provisions and some of the bills and legislation that are being passed, we're given much more flexible implementation time. Our final comment before I pass on to my colleague Rosemary is regarding the implementation period. As previously stated, we worried about the cost of business, the cost to business rather, to implement this bill. It will represent a significant strain on resources. There will need to be an investment in IT systems and processes, and some businesses cannot afford to implement the bill in the time that's stipulated in the draft bill. We also worry that, in light of the other two acts that have already been passed, in particular the Consumer Protection Act, which we are aware that this is not in the ambit of this committee, but rather the Trade and Industry Committee, we would require more time to ensure that business is fully prepared to implement the provisions. Honourable Chair, at this point, I will pass on to my colleague from ASSISA. Thank you.
Yeah, are we ready for the next? Chair, there seems to be a pause that needed at the computer.
Should I assume that the presentation remarks made by Mr. Swiss is included in the submission?
There are two submissions that are made, one from Service Unit South Africa and then a separate one from ASSISA. But we have been working together and we are collaborating on some of the issues.
What is shared by the African family?
Yes, it is.
Okay.
Technical problems. Our capacity as Parliament or as representative incapacity. Is our system in that situation? Oh, okay, thank you. I'm told it has been resolved. Good morning, Mr. Chambers and members of the Honourable House. It seems that we have sorted out the parcel problem. ASSISA has made written submissions, which I trust have been circulated to the honourable members. The submission today is just a summation thereof, briefly to hopefully bring clarity or to provide some background for our written submissions. The first slide is basically just a presentation as to who ASSISA is. As stated on the slide before you, it's an organisation consisting of members conducting business in the financial services industry, consisting of life insurers, collective investment schemes, investment managers, and linked investment services providers. ASSISA is also a member of FUSA. As we stated in our written submission, as members will see on the slide, we particularly welcome the bill by reason of the fact that it is required internationally for our members in order to operate internationally, for example, to conduct third-party administration. By reason of the legislation in the European Union, in the UK, in Australia, our members have often not been able to conduct business such as third-party organization administration without legislation being in place. We are, however, concerned about the cost and the practical implementations inherent to the implementation of the law. And in this respect, we believe it's important to note that due to the nature of our business, or of our members' business rather, they deal with substantial volumes of personal information, unlike many other industries. Financial services, to a large extent, is premised on personal information. Most Russia and our members are large companies and have conducted business for many years, some of them for more than 100 years, and in the process one can appreciate that they have accumulated vast amounts of data over many decades. Now, technological developments have resulted over the years in data being stored in a number of different media. I'm sure that there's a number of the members of this Honourable House that will record it wasn't that long ago when one still worked with cobalt paper in order to create a receipt for somebody when you bought something at the shop. One would then take your receipt home and put it in a Viva Arch file. You would store all your receipts in the Viva Arch file on a year-to-year basis for tax returns and other purposes. As technology developed and we were introduced to word processors and microfilm and later to personal computers, one would start to store data on floppy disks, on sticky disks, on computers. That has now developed to a stage where one went from CDs to DVDs to memory sticks, which now enables one to walk around with all your personal information that you have gathered over the years if you have managed to reduce everything to electronic form around your neck. But that has resulted in the situation that most of us today have stored our personal information in various different media. We still have files in the attic or somewhere in a cupboard. We may still have floppy disks. We may still have CD disks with information concerning our own affairs, business affairs, our tax affairs. ASISA's members find itself in exactly the same situation, just in obviously a far more in a far bigger setup. We point out that technological development has also impacted on the way business is conducted in the financial services industry. Many years ago, the application for a policy, life policy for example, and the administration of that policy was something that was very labor intensive. It went about with the completion of a lot of information. The documentation was stored, policy files took up vast areas of space within a life insurance office, so much so that life officers often, for example, had to hire different premises or make use of companies like Metrofile for the storage of data. With the development of technology, however, businesses could reduce the labor intensity, they could make their systems more cost effective, faster, quicker, more efficient. That has developed over the time, and as we know, computer technology is one of the most rapid areas of development in the science industry today, and what is state of art today, maybe you could go out to the archive tomorrow. So our members have, by reason of that development over the years, adopted many different systems and formats in order to conduct its business. We have pointed out, for example, that one of our members has 180 systems and multiple subsystems on which it stores data, conducts its business, does its administration. The problem, and this is very important, Chairperson, is that the different systems are seldom compatible and difficult to integrate in order to link systems across various databases in order for one to create a single view. Again, with reference to one's own personal data, before you haven't collated or had a look at all your archive files, your floppy disks, your sticky disks, your CDs, it's very difficult to get a complete view as to all the data you have across those various forms of information. We then say, how does the bill impact on our CSIS members? And in this regard, we believe it's important to note that the definition of processing in the Act is very wide and includes almost every conceivable action in respect of personal information. We point out the definition in the Act that it includes the collection, receipt, recording, organization, collation, storage, updating and modification, retrieval, alteration, consultation and use, it includes dissemination by means of transmission, distribution, making available in any other form, or the merging, linking, as well as blocking, degrading, erasure. The point we're making, again with reference to those files in the attic that I spoke about, and those old sticky and floppy disks, as from the date of implementation of this Act, Chairperson, that mere storage of those files becomes processing and something that is subject to the Act. Now, if one has regard to the substantial amount of personal information in possession of our members, as I have indicated before, one can appreciate that the implementation of this Act is going to have a significant impact on our members, because all of a sudden the implementation will result in all that information being now, that is being stored only, even being regarded as being processing of information. We therefore point out these various impacts on our members. The one is a systems impact. Again, by reason of the privacy principles that have been included in the bill, our members will have to adopt their systems and amend their computer systems, change them in order to comply with this Act. In other words, they will have to, for example, change the systems or update the system so that one can record client consent and different preferences. The old opt-in, opt-out clauses that many of the members would have noted, for example, when you go on an internet site, you get asked, would you like to be notified of further updates, and you can click in, opt-in, yes, I would like to, no, I would not like to. Now, obviously, if one, as one must, by reason of the provisions of this bill, give clients that option to opt in, opt out, one must obviously ensure that one is in a position to honor the client's wishes, because otherwise you're really going to add insult to injury if you ask people whether they would like something and they said no, and you contact them in any event. We would have to, the systems will have to be able to categorize and classify data, for example, what constitutes special personal information. One will have to classify the data for purposes of levels of security, what people may have access to what information. One will have to be able to date stamp and store data in order to comply, for example, with Section 14 that says you may only keep it for the period for which it's strictly speaking necessary. As regards the securement of data, Chairperson, one will have to amend one's system to ensure that one can comply with the provisions on the Act pertaining to the security of data and the communication of any potential infringement thereof. Now, obviously, the amendment of updating of any computer program or the writing of a computer program is expensive. And what we are saying is, depending on what time frame our members will be given in order to make those changes will severely impact on the cost implication of this bill. Apart from systems impact, we also point out that in the next slide, there will be a significant or profound impact, I will say, on the existing data and processing. Again, with reference to the examples that I've given as regards the vast amount of data in our members' possession, if one has regard to Section 14, Section 14 provides that one can only keep data for so long as it was necessary. While that is very reasonable, the problem being if one sits on top of vast amounts of manual data or documentary data and on terabytes of information, before one can basically decide whether to destroy data or for what reasons you have retained data over the years, one will have to go and assess all that data. Now, obviously, that is going to take vast amounts of long periods of time and a lot of human resources. Also, as regards Section 60, information quality. In order to comply with that, one will again will have to have reference to your stored data in order to see whether you need to update that, whether you can destroy that, whether it needs to be amended. The next one, consent for further processing, sections 10 and 15 is another section that impacts on existing data. Over years, our members have collected data and have used it for various purposes. If they want to further process those data, for example, communicate with members in respect of new products, they will have to get the members' consent, maybe, in many of the situations, except if they are granted certain exemptions. Chairperson, we therefore point out that there will also be a significant impact on the financial resources of the company by reason of the systems that it will have to implement, the systems that it will have to change, and by reason of the fact that it will have to do so within a very short period of time, unless, as we submit, the time period is extended in order to allow members to do that in the normal course of their business. We say it's therefore clear that the bill will substantially impact on financial resources, on human resources. I think we may have skipped the slide there, Mr. Chairperson. What we have pointed out there is, in order to comply with this Act, in order for an organization to go through its data and to assess what information needs to be destroyed, what needs to be amended, what needs to use resources, it's obviously a phase with one's business, because it's only those people that will be able to make the decision. If I can again compare it with one's, with regard to one's own information, if you have to go back to those files on the ASIC and to your floppy disk and your sticky disk, because there's now an Act that says certain information you must destroy and others you must keep, you can hardly not appoint somebody else to go and do the job for you, because they don't necessarily have this insight in what the information is about. In addition, going forward, there will have to be a lot of training of members in order to be compliant, of the members' employees to be compliant with the Act and to create a culture of compliance. One of our members have estimated that more than 10,000 of their members will be involved dealing with personal information and will require training, and that cost alone will be in excess of 4.5 million. Yeah, thanks. We then pointed out in our written submissions with some more information than what is stated here, Chairperson, that the impact of the implementation of privacy legislation has been recognized in foreign jurisdictions and allowances has been made in that regard. We point out that, for example, the European Union Directive of 1995 allows member states 3 years to adopt practices and systems required to comply and 12 years to comply with existing manual data. The UK Data Protection Act in 1998 only came into force 2 years after it was consented to, and further provided for 19 months in respect of all processing already underway. In respect of manual data, I apologize, a further 6 years exemption was granted to business and organizations in order to comply. We therefore say, Chairperson, that in view of the significant impact which this bill will have on business, and by reason thereof, on the data subjects as well, because obviously, if one employs resources to ensure that one is compliant with this Act, those resources cannot concentrate on the core business. That obviously has a chain reaction and an impact on the data subjects themselves. So we say there should at least be a hiatus period of 12 months in all probability. 24 months will be more realistic, Chairperson, in order for business to adopt its systems and adopt its business practices in order to comply with the Act. We are aware of this fact that Section 104 does make allowance for a phasing in period, but as we have stated in our submission, written submission, Chairperson, we believe believe it should be fixed in the Act that the Act will only come into force at least 12 months or 24 months after it has been assented to. The reason for that is, while the Act is presently drafted, does empower the President to promulgate when the Act will commence. It's a bit, if I may be allowed the example, of being told he's playing a rugby match tomorrow, but he doesn't know when the kickoff starts. Business needs to have certainty, a chairperson, to know that at least they have at least 12 months or 24 months in order to update their systems, to put them in a position that if the Act then comes into operation, that they can comply with the Act. We also say that additional transitional relief and exemptions should be provided for in respect of existing data and processing already taking place. We've given more examples and suggestions in our written submissions, Chairperson, with reference to foreign jurisdictions. We also have stated in our written submissions that the information officer should be, together with the minister, who presently, in terms of Section 113, has the authority to give further extension, that the information officer, information protection officer, my apologies, should also be given these powers. This is the officer who will be tasked to oversee the Act, and we believe we should also be afforded the powers to extend the implementation of certain provisions. As regards existing data, especially, Chairperson, we believe that there is merit in making a distinction between what I may refer to as so-called active processing as opposed to passive processing. And if I may take a minute to try and explain, any dissemination of one's personal data, in the sense that it is passed on to somebody else, it is seen by somebody else, it is published or it is communicated to you, is obviously something that directly impacts on data subjects and lies at the heart for the reason for this Act. I think as Mrs. Smith correctly pointed out. On the other hand, by reason of the wide definition, there's many forms of processing, such as storage, which doesn't really impact on data subjects. If somebody applied for a policy 30 years ago, the fact that the information is still stored somewhere, it doesn't really impact on that because it's not communicated to somebody else, it's not further processed. So we believe that there's a lot of merit in making those distinctions, and it will detract to a large extent if the necessary exemptions can be granted from the financial impact on our members as regards to systems and the human resources that they will have to employ. As I have already stated on a number of occasions, our principal submissions are recorded in our written submissions, and as stated therein, we could unfortunately not, in the time afforded, conduct a detailed analysis of specific provisions nor provide appropriate drafting amendments if the committee or the drafters of the Act wish us to make suggestions. Indeed, of course, we are ever willing to do so. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you very much. I'm sorry you will be allowed to make sense of this in a different way. The last comment about the department wanting to get more from you. So that will most certainly encourage. And members, that was with Honorable Sun and Honorable Sinis.
Thank you, Chairperson, and thank you for the Commission. Firstly, I would like to understand the lead lag process, and maybe you're not in a position to answer that, but I'd like the department as well as to answer why this bill does not go through the lead lag process. Secondly, the issue of the regulatory burdens. I just need a bit more information about that agreement. Thirdly, I was going to say the additional submissions, there's always that practice if you want to make additional written submissions, and we welcome those, particularly relating to specific provisions that you'd like amended and specific wording. Then just as far as the financial implications are concerned, clearly when you speak on paragraph 5.6, Mr. Davies, the initial high-level impact, you speak about 750
million rand during 1 year. Now that's huge implications that we as a committee need to consider. Obviously that would then be built into your costs and it will result in less profit, which will mean less revenue to the state. And we are looking at a huge budget deficit at the moment of almost 7% of GDP. So there are huge financial consequences that we need to know. And I would really like you, if possible, to give us more information on those implications of the implementation, how we then can look at that when we consider the time scale of implementing. As you pointed out, it is section 104, the incremental implementation of that. So that is something that is a huge concern to me, having sitting on the finance committee as well, and aware of our budget process. But if you could, in due course, give us specific wording as your proposal. You are committed to the Act, if you say not your impact beginning, but how we can then look at some of these issues. Thank you very much, Chairperson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I will support the request for having as many textual amendments as possible because it will help us understanding what the real issues are. But having said that, Mr. Chairman, I would like, if the presenter could help me with the difficulty I have in comprehension from a business viewpoint, as I read this deal, which is beautifully drafted, I got sucked into its logic. And it's beautiful logic, everything is consequential, everything is covered. But the image that brought to my mind was that of the internet business, the collection of data, the mailing list, the soliciting, etc. But I wonder about the law of unintended consequences, and I try to apply my mind to what business does this bill does not apply to. And I've had an enormous difficulty of finding one, at least in my exposure to business and my experience of business, because everyone has got a Rolodex on its desk, and the Rolodex is covered. Everyone has got the mailing list of its customers. Everyone processes information, because keeping information is processing information. It's got to be that way, because the logic of the bill requires, and it's got to be that time. It's got to be that keeping is processing. So I reached the conclusion, which I would like to be disabused of, that each and every conceivable business falls within the scope of application on this field. It has to be so. So that means that each and every business needs to notify the regulator to be a processor. And the entire purpose, and it will lead to the registration of all businesses in the country, which is something that one has tried to avoid for many years. So that's the first difficulty that I have. And perhaps I am wrong. Who does it apply to? And who doesn't? The second difficulty is what does it really require people to do? And again, in an internet environment, the list of obligations are understandable. But in a non-internet environment, the old shopkeeper who gives the list of customers and sends the newsletter and keeps the information is not like the one I have who keeps resumes of all the secretaries who applied, etc. All these obligations, how do they, because as the presenter correctly pointed out, it's management time. It's not, you can't have a secretary conducting this compliance work. If there is an issue on the necessity, there is an issue. I wonder whether we could not receive a document, not now, from a business perspective, which lists all the obligations as taken out of this deal, so that we can quantify what a big company and a mom and pop business are equally required to do. And this is my second question. So who, what? And my third question, if I can read my handwriting, is I have a logical problem with the stop work notice. I call it stop work notice because that's what effectively is, where the regulator thinks that there is a violation and stops the work of a business, as the city would do with the construction site, and then one needs to take it to court to have it reactivated. I mean, the processing of information is very, it's not clear what it is that it stops, because technically speaking, once it stops, it can stop my accessing my email address. representing our CMEP, which is using the role as expert in this matter, because it's all encompassing. So I want to know whether it is a pernicious to business as I perceive it to be. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Firstly, what I'd like to know is from both Busa and CISA, what level are these submissions made on? CISA has a long list of its members and affiliates and associates and everything else. I know that Busa membership is extensive, but I don't know the structures of either organization. But are these submissions products of researchers, or are they mandated by the structures? Get some clarity on that. Then, this is why I was asked for a response from the department on NEDLAC. I don't have a copy of the NEDLAC act in front of me, but my understanding is that it's not correct to say that if a party wants something brought there, it has to be brought. It's limited to labour matters, and then there's a broader provision for economic policy. That's basically it. And this doesn't concern labour matters, it might concern economic policy, but it's not legislation, it's policy. That's one of the gaps in the NEDLAC Act. And then if a party is aggrieved, and this has happened before, they approach NEDLAC to approach Parliament. I don't know who has approached NEDLAC on that. And in which case, I'm not sure why NEDLAC hasn't come here. So that's just basically the one in commentary, but they still get. So I suppose the question to Busa would be, have you approached NEDLAC to complain? Because respectfully, I don't think my understanding of the law is not the same as yours. The other one is basically, look, the fundamental point on both submissions is the cost and the amount of time it will take to implement. Now, I think, again, one needs more detail. It's fine to come with big figures. I know Busa complained that they expected government to do a regulatory impact assessment. I would have thought that the businesses should have done a regulatory impact assessment. But I'm interested, for example, that I know they're coming later, and they can maybe explain why they've left it out, but the Banking Association doesn't mention cost at all. First Brand, they're not coming, but they've got a written submission. They don't mention cost either. So it's surprising that ASISA and Busa are so concerned that these established bodies are not raising costs as a prime issue. With implementation, the implementation can be delayed. As you pointed out, it's a year, and then that can be extended. I know that ASISA, in your submission, you presented a table with different sections. But you haven't explained why. You put UK, New Zealand at the date that you'd like, but you haven't explained why. I mean, business with respect always wants more time. So I think with both issues, with costing, not necessarily now, but a later submission, come with more detail why it's going to cost so much. And then, and can you think of any? I know you've linked cost to the implementation period. But with the implementation period, why do you want each section to be implemented over a particular period of time?
Thank you, Chairperson. I'm going to link on a lot to what Honourable Jefferson has just mentioned. You spoke quite extensively about documentation that is stored, that in fact you are not processing, but because of the implementation of this act, it will be considered as processing of information, even though it's being stored. I think you use the example of electro files and storing documents in warehouses. Now, of course, we all know that document destruction is terribly costly. In fact, to destroy documents, it always used to make me laugh that you would have to pay for the destruction and then pay for the recycling. And you would get, as business, none of the money back, and the particular destruction company would get all the money, even though you had already paid them for the destruction of the documents. Now, while this is all good and well that we know it's going to cost business a lot of money to destroy these documents, etc., what is your alternative? What do we do from a legal point of view to make sure that this documentation is destroyed or kept safe? But look after a consumer as well as a business. And I think that links on to what Honourable Jeffries was saying is that we need you to give us more detail from your side as to what would make your life easier but still protect the consumer and still protect people's information.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. My question is directed to the young lady. Just a small question of clarity. To quote your words, young lady, you said, let me say, put it this way. What do you consider, to use your words, to be a much more flexible consultation time? Could you kindly explain this to the committee?
Thank you, Kate. On the first question, regarding the NEDLAC process, if a NEDLAC chamber, for example, on whatever basis requests that a government department tables a particular policy and or legislation, in the past we have used policy and legislation interchangeably. It is the expectation of the other constituents that the particular government department will then table that particular policy at NEDLAC. We have obviously raised this matter with NEDLAC. The department has agreed to actually table the bill ex post. So from this week, we expect that the department will be going back to NEDLAC. But it could have been much more useful, and some of the issues that are being raised here today would have been addressed at much earlier time, and it could have actually led to some amendments to the draft bill. That is really our issue, as I said. And as far as the regulatory burden is concerned, as part of the ASCESA process, government clearly identified the regulatory red tape as an impediment to business and therefore to economic growth in South Africa. And one of the responses that were clearly identified was the implementation of a regulatory impact assessment framework. The responsibility for the RIA implementation rested with the presidency, as well as the National Treasury being the lead department. We've had numerous discussions with both the presidency and the National Treasury on this matter. We were told that at the time the government officials were still being trained on appropriate measures. It's been more than 2 years. The understanding was that when a government department is still formulating policy, even during the drafting stage, they would consider the implications not just to the state, but also to business, and develop a bill or rather legislation that would minimize the cost for business. This is quite important for us because we are facing several challenges. As an honorable member stated, the economy growth is, we're going to have negative economic growth for this year. We face with challenges in high cost of utilities and energy, and therefore regulatory burden can actually be a challenge, especially for small businesses who don't have the financial resources to actually implement some of the laws. The question on whether our submission was mandated, maybe I'll explain how we work at BUSA. We have more than 52 member organizations, ranging from ASISA, the Banking Association, Chemical and Allied Association, NAFCOC, FABCOS. It's really across the spectrum, representing both small business and big business, black business and white business. In as far as the approach for this particular bill is concerned, our first point of call was to actually set up a task team where all of our member organizations had an option to nominate a delegate. We then, when the call for submissions came out, we asked our members for comments. So essentially our document and our submission is, in most parts, mandated by our members. And we are representing their views in as far as we can. Thank you.
Chair, I mean, it's one thing to ask members for submissions, but was the draft shown to members? You know, what structure of BUSA looked at the draft?
Thank you. The PPI task team falls under the Economic Policy Committee, which is a subcommittee of our management committee. So indeed, the draft was sent to the committee and it was approved. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. I will do my best to try and recall which questions to me. number of the issues to my colleagues, who I believe is better positioned to respond to those questions. As regards the question posed by yourself, Chairperson, as to why we say we were not in a position to give more detailed submission in respect of the bill itself, the actual drafting thereof, the clauses thereof, members of the CISA, more especially the former Life Officers Association, have in the past liaised with the Law Commission that was responsible for drafting this Act. We have made input at the time, etc. But as regards the bill presently before this committee, to the best of my knowledge, that was only published for comment on the 24th of September this year, the actual bill. Now, in an organization such as the CISA, that will entail that one will have to copy your members with that bill, ask them for commentary. All of the people that may be in a position to comment on the bill has also other responsibilities. So, unfortunately, in the 2 weeks that was afforded, it was not possible to in detail comment on a section to section on the bill or make proposals. Obviously, before one makes legislative proposals in respect of a bill or the provisions of the bill, one must ensure that one doesn't make proposals that may have unintended consequences himself. As regards the various questions posed by Mr. Swart, as regards NEDLAC, my colleague Fabus has already answered that. I will agree with Mr. Jeffrey that this bill doesn't concern labor directly at all, but I think it's debatable whether or not it doesn't has reference to social and economic policy. I think it definitely impacts on social and economic policy. The bill itself is basically a deviation of the way most people and businesses went about with private information, but that is my humble submission in that regard. As regards the specific wording of the Act, we welcome the invitation to make submissions in that regard, and perhaps we can get some clarity on what specific provisions the committee would like us to make submissions once they had the opportunity to study the written submissions. In other words, once the committee has had the opportunity to read our written submissions, they may ask us to, I presume, in conjunction with the Law Commission, to make proposals in respect of specific sections in the Act. As regards the questions posed by Mr. Albersini, yes, Chairperson, indeed, the Act will impact on every business in this country that has personal data. And the bigger the business and the more personal data it has, the more significant this impact is going to have. That's why we have said in our written submissions and in my oral presentation that for members of the CISA, bearing in mind the nature of their business and the amount of data that they have, the impact of this bill as regards finances, as regards human resources, as regards business operations and systems is immense. It is not something that one can fix with the introduction of a turnkey solution by reason of the reasons that we have mentioned. And again, Chairperson, one needs to make a distinction when one, and there is a need to implement this Act. As I've stated, we are not saying we want a watered-down piece of legislation. We are not saying that we should not have a bill protecting privacy. We welcome this bill. But what we are saying is if one goes forward in business, one can obviously adopt one system so that in future when you get an application, you can deal with that information in a certain manner which will make it easy for you to comply with the Act. So you will write your system so to record name of the member or the applicant, the address, the ID number, the financial information provided to you as regards salary, etc., the debit orders, all that, and you will be able to link onto your systems warnings or flags or whatever to later on warn you that this policy has now paid out, more than 3 years have expired, and you may now no longer have any need to keep this information. You may then delete that information. You will also be able to build into one's system, I presume, the opt-in, opt-out principle, so that the member can elect or give you consent that you may pass on his or her information to some of your associate companies or other groups in the company so that they can be informed of information. But that takes time, Chairperson. It takes time, it takes money, it takes resources. Now, from a CSIS viewpoint, all our members are on an ongoing basis implementing new technology. What we are saying is we need to be afforded the opportunity to, in the normal course of business, implement the necessary changes into our systems in order to comply with this Act going forward as from date of implementation. But having said that, there's the other big elephant standing out in the field, and that is the past, or actually as we sit here speaking, the present. Those are the files in the attic that I referred to. Those are the terabytes of information that we have collected over the years. As regards what we should do with that, obviously we should safeguard that. There should be provisions to ensure that that information is not disseminated, that that information, if it's stored, is stored and secured. We have systems in place to secure our data already. One will obviously have to update that. But in respect of many of the other principles, if one wishes to apply that to existing data that is stored, and the reason why they're stored, to give the members an example, Chairperson, one may, for example, have a life policy with a 20-year term that will mature, let's say, in February 2010. According to one's records and the application one has received, the policyholder purported or ostensibly surrendered this policy in 2005. One can, however, not destroy that policy file or the records pertaining to the surrender payment, because in 2010 you may be in a position, as happens to us from time to time, receiving an application from the member or a query, when am I receiving my maturity benefits? Whereupon you will reply, well, what maturity benefits? You've surrendered this policy in 2005. And he says, Jesus, I never surrendered anything. In those circumstances, one needs to retain that documentation in order to be able to prove the payment or to go after the person that has defrauded you, presenting himself or herself as a policy officer. Now, there are various examples that I may use why we keep documents. We don't keep them just for the sake of keeping them. If we're storing documents, as Michael correctly pointed out, is an expensive exercise. The destruction thereof is not inexpensive. But I think what needs to be appreciated, and it links up to another question, how much is it going to cost? Well, we have not, unfortunately, been in a position to do an exact cost-benefit analysis, but the figures that we have extracted and that we have provided as a preliminary figure have been resulted from investigations being done by some of our members as regards how many systems do we have, what data sits on every system, taking into account what we will have to do to research that data, update that data, destroy that data. As I said, it will take human resources, it will take system changes. And if one has regard to the totality of this, if you say that this Act needs to be implemented in due course, in other words, you have to specifically, without implementing changes as part of your ongoing business plan, that just in order to comply with this Act, it will amount to millions in addition to what it otherwise will be. what level the submission was made. I can defer to my colleague, Ms. Lightbody, in that regard, as I've already said, CISA operates on the basis that it will circulate all its the relevant bill to its members and ask it for comment. What we'll normally have legal advisors, systems people in this case, looking at the bill and advise you what is feasible, what is not feasible, what is the problems of implementation, and at the end of the day, and that was primarily the work of my colleague, Mr. Stephen, whom I refer in this regard, one will collate all that information and present it to the committee in as best way as one can in the time that was awarded. But the committee will appreciate do all that in 2 weeks, get input, distill what people have said, put it into a format that's easily understandable. It's not that easy. Before I hand over to my colleagues, just as regards to the detail of the impact and the reason for the various or the different terms, my colleague Tepler will be able to address the committee on that, but I just want to point out in paragraph 5.7 of our written submissions, we have drawn a comparison between those activities that is going to have a significant financial impact on members in order to comply with those and the others that may have a less financial impact. And I would presume, or my understanding is, that the time period that we have proposed, Jeffrey, in the table are very much premised on foreign legislation and the way they have dealt with those specific issues, but with reference to what is high impact from a financial and human resource perspective and what is the lower impact. I will then hand over to my colleagues to address those two specific issues.
Before the presenter does so, my first question has not been answered, probably on account of my having put it to it not sufficiently clear and clumsy. May I put it again, Mr. Chairman? The question that I asked was, on the basis of the presenter's experience, can you think of a business to which this bill does not apply in considering that each business has email addresses coupled with names and phone numbers and physical addresses, and if we use them or keep them? And if that is the case, would there be business in South Africa that you know that would not need to register in terms of not notify in terms of this deal the regulator of being for processing information?
My personal submission will be that regarding had to be provisions or the definition of processing and the definition of personal information, that there is no business in South Africa that doesn't process personal information. I must confess at this moment I'm not that afraid to what extent one may be exempted from applying in certain cases, but to answer your question, whether there's any business that doesn't process personal information in this country, my personal opinion is no. There can't be any.
Yeah, as I said, I wanted to talk about inactive processing. That possibly covers elements of that question. But yes, that is the elephant you refer to, but in terms of the details, I might not. But now, let's hand over to
the question with regard to how the process was followed within ASISA. Just to let you know that a work group was established within ASISA. All ASISA members were asked to nominate representatives, which did happen in the main. Those representatives have met on 2 occasions, have conducted a workshop, extensive workshops, in between carrying out those workshops. They have gone back within their organizations and done the research and consultation that they could within the time. So these workshops were set up and the consultation and work and discussions were held as soon as possible after the Bill of 2009 was published. But as has been mentioned, I don't want to labour the point, the time within which to get all of this detail together has been extremely limited, and to come with accurate estimates in the light of the extensive application of the bill and implications of the bill, accurate cost estimates was not possible in the time afforded. It is true that there was consultation over the previous years, but the last bill that the industry has seen that has been made public was in 2007, to which submissions were made, and we were not aware as to how successful or otherwise the submissions had been, so we had no idea what to expect in the 2009 bill. So it was not really possible to go out and do extensive estimates in respect of a bill that we hadn't seen. With regard to the banks not having raised any cost issues, my understanding that in fact the banks do have cost issues, and a colleague who is sitting to my left is in a position to actually comment on that. They are also part of the Bursa delegation.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. On the issue of the costs relating to the implementation of the Protection of Personal Information Bill, I am responsible for compliance management in one of the big four banks in the country, and we have done a work impact analysis of the bill where we identified what areas would be affected and how badly. And then also we engaged with people involved in similar type projects to get an estimation of the costs. And we were told a cost of $200 million from a systems point of view, which excludes, of course, staff training and the cost of contacting customers. And on a similar vein, the Consumer Protection Act, which I'm responsible for as well, has a budget of 100 million rand. And that has a much more limited scope in a banking environment whereby credit agreements are excluded from the scope of that act and other aspects relating to financial services. And it doesn't have a big impact on system changes. So I think it is safe to say that the cost would be a lot more for the implementation of the PPI, in that it cuts across the entire organisation. It applies to both individuals and juristics where the Consumer Protection Act will have a threshold in place, and also it has a high impact on system changes, and I'm sure if we all know, anything which involves IT resources or system changes does have a huge cost attached to it. Thank you.
My I don't know if the Banking Association, I mean, they are coming later, they can talk to themselves. Submission 22, there's just no mention of cost. I don't know, you say you're one of the big four. Are you first grand? No. That's submission 20, nothing about cost. So maybe the time was too short that they couldn't, they forgot to look at it.
The main
cost
coming
in,
I think,
so
they can
make an
answer
to
that. Okay.
Thank you very much. We do note the limited time that you have put across throughout the presentation. And I believe we have exhausted this part. Thank you very much, most sincerely. Moving on.
You see in your paragraph 4.8.2, you are also over and above the call for clarity with regard to when are you expected. There's a call you made, that it must be specific in 104, with regard to when would you be expected to comply. Over and above that, you are making another call in 4.8.2, where you are saying allowance should be made under Section 34 for the Information Protection Regulator on application to provide temporal exemption in respect of one or more provisions for the Act, and where a particular industry cannot reasonably be expected to achieve. That sort of call comes across either as speculator or, if it's not speculator, what is its motivation, taking into account that in 34 you've got paragraph A and B?
We had already dismounted the horse and we were putting back on the saddle. That's fine. Yeah, that's good. Yeah, thank you. try and answer the question, Chairperson. Can the Honourable Member just refer me to the first paragraph, or mention the first paragraph he was referring to? Were you referring to the section of the Act?
Okay.
Thank
you. This is the report that which the line was about. You are requesting that the IPA 76 is actually the river that is being used for the whole of the 4.6.
That is correct.
Now, what I'm saying to you
is either to be it either amount of speculatory proposal, or if not, what is its motivation in taking to account paragraph A and B? Because paragraph A and B says the regulator can allow, even if there's a breach, the process of work permission, if the public interest in the processing outweighs all those elements under that, or the processing involves a clear benefit to the data subject and so on. What I'm trying to say, how is your cause excluded there? Because if it's not excluded there, if you don't show how it's excluded there, then this becomes speculation over and above the request for clarity of when are you supposed to comment.
Again, Mr. Chairperson, perhaps I can answer the question like this. For business, it's obviously important to have clarity as regards its obligations as corporate citizens in terms of the legislation. It also needs to have clarity as to when it will have to comply with that legislation. Now, again, if one makes a distinction between going forward as from the date of the commencement of this Act, in other words, being in a position, let's say, 1 March next year onwards, one will have to put systems in place in order to comply with the Act in respect of all data that one collects as from the 1st of March, stores as from the 1st of March going forward. Unless one has a specific date to know that you will be expected, for example, to comply with this Act as from 1 March 2011. Business, regarding how this Act is now drafted, does not know when the President will think it fit to introduce the commitment of the Act. As regards the other proposals that we have in 4.2b, what we are saying is the regulator does have certain powers in terms of the Act, and one may approach the regulator in respect of certain processing to be done. What we are asking for in our submission is to be granted specific exemptions for periods of time so that one doesn't...
Can I correct something, Chairman? Sorry. What I'm saying is that I think there's sympathy, there's a considered sympathy, that it is important for business to know, after the president has signed this into law, within which period should you be accepted so that it can be done. I don't think there's a debate around that. That's why members are asking for a particular information to further, in a very transparent way, explain why the situation is unique and different from others. And I think that's not where the debate is. I'm talking about your 4.8.2, which seems to be proposing a perpetual possibility. Because if you say the regulator must be given those powers, you are suggesting that even after 20 years, 30 years, he may find circumstances under which you propose that. And I'm saying, why do you think it is not covered by paragraphs A and B that concern? Because if we were to follow that, we're proposing a perpetual what we call
what are we trying to solicit? I'm trying to understand the question really.
But I think I understand.
Yeah, you do. Yeah, I understand.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The question, as I understand it, is that Section 34 in the bill does provide for the regulator authorizing a responsible party, I'm reading from the bill, to process personal information, even if that process is in breach of an information protection principle. But it goes on to say that it's only the case if the regulator is satisfied in the circumstances of the case that the public interest would outweigh the interfering of the privacy of the data subject,
all the processing involves a clear benefit to the state, to the data subject. And in the next section, it says the public interest, and it lists what the public interest would be. Our concern is that that is a limited set of circumstances, which where you have a corporate citizen, a company, which is trying its best to comply with the legislation. It has put its mind to it, it has engaged people to do it, but unforeseen circumstances, which always happen, especially when you're dealing with systems and computers and technology, it could be that it's going to take them now 6 months longer than they had already, that they had budgeted for. The key person falls ill. Now they need a special set of circumstances. They have a special set of circumstances. They need a special exemption. They need someone who they can approach and say, from the best of intentions, we cannot get this process 100% compliant by the day. Could we please have a could you please consider an exemption for X period of time? We feel rather than having to come back to Parliament to ask for that, which is the most very impractical solution for such a set of circumstances, that the regulator be empowered. He doesn't have to say yes, he or she doesn't have to, after consideration, agree to this, but at least could have the power to do it in reasonable and suitable circumstances.
May I make my last comment, Sir, on this matter?
Yeah, we're running out of time on this subject. Please.
You will discover, Chairperson, the clarity on this question is very important. Well, what I'm saying is that probably in engaging the Act closely, one may understand what they're trying to get at. Because if you look at what you just said, that is a subsection 2. I'm not sure where it says the public interest referred in subsection 1 includes, whether it is exhaustive to those which are there. We have to actually first interrogate that. Because if it is not exhaustive, then the concern may be covered in one way or another with regard to paragraph A and B, but it's a matter that we need to examine very closely.
Thank you, Honorable Ngongo Bello. And now I can assure you that we are off the hook. Let's get Nelson Mandela Foundation, please.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, members of the committee. My real job is as Madiba's archivist, but I'm here today in my capacity as acting CEO of the Nelson Mandela Foundation and representing both the foundation and the South African History Archive. Let me, in just a couple of minutes, explain our interest in this bill. The South African History Archive was established in the mid-1980s as an underground memory collection project, with documentation being smuggled out of the country for safekeeping. After 1990, it continued to document struggles for justice in South Africa. It has today a huge collection of materials at the University of the Witwatersrand, much of it containing personal information, and all of it collected, processed, and made available outside the parameters determined by this bill. In terms of the Nelson Mandela Foundation, Madiba launched the Center of Memory and Dialogue in 2004. And its purpose is to document the life and times of Nelson Mandela. We have a substantial collection of materials, the heart of it being Madiba's private papers. And in those papers is to be found personal information about his comrades, his colleagues, his family, and his friends. Again, none of this has been acquired by us or has been managed by us according to the principles enunciated in the bill. In our view, then, it is imperative that the special needs and mandates of archival institutions be accommodated by the bill. Second primary area of interest for us is the bill's close articulation with and linkage to the Promotion of Access to Information Act. The two pieces of legislation are companions to two parts of a whole. And as Odak pointed out, the Open Democracy Bill, which was first drafted in 1995, had the sections on protection of personal information and access to information within that one bill. The South African History Archive, since 2001, has been using the Promotion of Access to Information Act to put into the public domain documentation mainly from the apartheid era, which it believes should be accessible to all South Africans. And the Nelson Mandela Foundation, since 2004 and the establishment of the Centre of Memory and Dialogue, has been using the Promotion of Access to Information Act to secure access to documentation about Madiba, his family members, and so on. From that experience, we believe that it's imperative that the regulatory mechanisms of the Protection of Information Bill and the Promotion of Access to Information Act are harmonized. That by way of introduction. In terms of our overall assessment of this bill, some of us in the two organizations have been following the bill's development since 1995. And we are now very comfortable with its content and believe that it now constitutes a well-considered and finely crafted piece of legislation. We only have difficulties in three particular areas, and those have been detailed in the written submission. Now, two of those areas have been addressed already by ODAC and have been discussed quite extensively, so I will cover them just a few comments. The first one has to do with the definition of personal information in the bill. And as was pointed out by Jack, there is this strange part of the definition which says, and where it is applicable, existing juristic persons. Now, for us, as we read the bill, we don't see the need for this element within the definition. It's unnecessary, inappropriate, and in our view, it opens the door to organizations, especially companies and corporations, claiming rights to privacy, which constitutionally they're not entitled to. So we're requesting the committee to look very closely at the need for adding juristic persons into the definition of personal information. The second area where we have a concern relates to Section 32, Special Personal Information. Now, I think you'll appreciate that given the nature of the holdings of most archival institutions, the great body of that material falls within this definition of special personal information, political views, and so on. This is the stuff of documentation of the struggles against apartheid and struggles for justice since 1994. In an earlier draft of this bill, the 2005 draft, in this section, there was a specific exemption covering the work of archival institutions. The wording used at the time was for scientific research undertaken or statistics held in the public interest. And we note now that this exemption has fallen away. In discussions with drafters of the bill, we believe that this was an oversight. It shouldn't have been left out, and we're asking the committee then to look closely at the possibility of restoring a special exemption to institutions, and I take the point that was made earlier, it should be about activities, the activity being for historical, statistical, or research purposes. The third and final area of concern for us to do with the harmonization of the bill with the Promotion of Access to Information Act. The regulator is given robust powers in relation to the Protection of Information, Personal Information Bill, but as has been pointed out by ODAC, it inherits from the Human Rights Commission weak powers in relation to the Promotion of Access to Information Act. Now for us, this is a critical moment where Parliament could use this opportunity to address what are serious problems with the implementation of the Promotion of Access to Information Act. It's common cause that we have desperately needed some regulatory authority, whether it's a commission or a regulator, to deal with disputes over access to information and to make binding orders. We don't believe, and some of the members have raised this point, that it would require a major new investigation into implementation of PIA. We have looked at the written submission made by Professor Ian Curry. Now, he has been for 8 years a member of the drafting team for the Protection of Personal Information Bill, and we've worked closely with him on a number of other projects. He has submitted to you what are a few amendments to the Promotion of Access to Information Act. In other words, these would be included in the schedule to this bill. And we support all of his proposals and ask that the committee look at these closely. We think that this will ensure that what is now an unevenness, a disparity in the role played by the regulator in relation to the two pieces of legislation will be addressed. That's all from us. Thank you.
Thank you. That was very helpful. Number of questions? Yeah, well presented. Thank you. Starting with
honorable. Thank you for the question. Briefly, again, going to the issue of excluding juristic persons and your views on that. You touched on it in your submission. I think give us your views on that. Thank you.
Yes, on the extension of the activity of collection of personal information for historical research or scientific purposes, I, through you, Mr. Chairman, wholeheartedly agree with the presenter, but I can see the other side to the argument. I would like to put the other side of the argument to see how it can be addressed. And I guess that the other side would go something along this line. This information, historical, research, and scientific, is of much greater momentum for the whole of society than the one collected by a Microsoft Corporation. So it needs to be kept accurate, it needs to be relevant, etc., etc. So it must be subjected to the regulatory process. And within the regulatory process, within the code of conduct, there is sufficient provision within the bill to make the relevant extension to ensure that the there is a special consideration and regulation of these three categories. So that would be what your reaction to this argument would be.
If you worry about the juristic person, inclusion, which to me doesn't seem to be saying generally to juristic person, it's very applicable. If you look at the purpose of the Act, where it says the aim is to balance the right to privacy against our right, particularly the right of access to information, and to generally protect important interests, including the and so on, to balance the right between those two, being the aim of the Act. Maybe through your counseling and your advice, don't you think there are juristic influence
that would actually be entitled to special protection with regard to information. It's not about that if you talk about things like trade secrets and others, and where would you place those if you do not place them, if you also don't ensure that they are covered by this, because there is certain information which aid to the people might be exclusively entitled to. I'm not sure how do you take into account the purpose of what to call, the purpose of the act, and the fact that it is not generally applied to juristic persons. Of course, I'm not sure if I was asking anything more than Honorable Amosin on the historic purpose. I find it quite also very interesting. The reason I'm raising this is that there is an instance where a writer of a book, for instance, a court had to decide in favor of the person affected by the content of the book, and then the court deciding in favor of the non-writer, who is not the author of the book. Because if I'm listening to you carefully, you are speaking on behalf of the writer, the author, that for that purpose. But where would you, what would you comment in that, take into account what is already occurred in South Africa today? Because there are instances where that sort of right could be abused at the expense of irreparable damage to individuals.
That sounds very familiar about the right of a book. It could have happened here in Cape Town. Please, let's.
Thanks for that. We welcome the introduction of the principles defined in this bill, because I think for too long archivists and other memory practitioners have failed to properly recognize and protect the rights of individuals as they relate to the contents of the material that they curate. So, for example, Madiba can donate to us his personal papers and say to us, well, you decide what goes into the public domain. But what he hasn't considered is that he has in that collection letters written to him by other individuals disclosing personal information of theirs. Or he has, in notebooks, taken down information about people, third parties, whose interests need to be taken into account. So I think that the principles are healthy ones, and it's timely that we begin to address these issues as we manage these collections. But to address the specific questions, in terms of juristic persons, if you look at the implementation of privacy legislation in other countries, and more broadly at societies which have begun to embrace privacy as a principle and as a value, there is a danger which one sees in many countries of organizations, and I mentioned this in my brief presentation, particularly corporations, utilizing the notion of privacy as a means of protecting themselves from legitimate scrutiny. So, for example, you will have corporations resisting trade unions collecting information about their operations, which in any reasonable analysis is important and legitimate for the exercise of the rights of the trade union concerned. Our concern here would be if you open the door to juristic persons being able to enjoy the protection afforded in this bill, the trade unions legitimately documenting employers might find themselves constrained in ways that haven't been foreseen by the drafters. In the same way, we've seen around the world corporations which are accused of damaging the environment, finding ways of frustrating civil society advocates from accessing information about their operations using this notion of privacy. So all we're saying is that we'd like the committee to think through very carefully the implications of juristic persons enjoying the rights defined here. To address, I think there's just the one other question then. Also to say that the rights of organizations, businesses, to reasonable protection in relation to their information is addressed by other legislation. And you need to look at that legislation. So the Protection of Information Act, for example, has provision for the protection of third-party commercial information. So these corporations and other organizations are not dependent on this bill only for reasonable protection. The final question, I think, had to do with the argument for the introduction into Section 32 of an exemption. I think you're right. There is provision here for an institution like the Nelson Mandela Foundation to apply to the regulator for special exemption. But we're arguing that there should be an exemption which covers the activity rather than only provision for specific and ad hoc requests for exemption. And we're making that argument on the basis of the logic of this bill itself, because if you look at other sections, like the processing of information, for example, there is such an exemption. In other words, this fell out of the process by mistake, and we're saying that it should be restored in order to give the bill the shape that the drafters want for it.
The historic issue. About the book. I wanted to say, now, having listened to your further clarification, I don't think you're opposed to this possibly being applicable to juridic persons, depending on how careful we have applied that. So I think that matter is clear. But I'm sure you will also take into account that the Access to Information Act also is affirming the right of access to information within particular principles. And the Labour Act also protects the right of unions to have access to particular information for the purpose of... So there's a general servicing of all those concerns to the best possibility our justice system can.
Thank you very much. We'll take Benjamin.
Thank you. Sorry, Mr. Chair, I'm going to need somebody to put it off the top. In its positioning in relation to this bill. We've had a
Becker client confidentiality requirements. It's a court case in 1923. So there's an 85, 86 year history on Becker client confidentiality, protection of personal and client information. Since then, we've been probably, the banks have probably been missing consent since the early days of the open democracy bill debate. It was the way it was going to happen, and also the international trend. So consent has probably been built into a large extent. We have the National Credit Act, which has been implemented, and there are data, personal privacy issues and marketing issues in that. Normal business processes relating to the management of information, the destruction of obsolete information, that's a normal business process. Maybe I'm a little bit battle scarred, but I survived FICA. And if you can survive FICA, it's part of this. You had to update your existing customer information. You have to re-verify that at certain frequencies. You have to keep that information for 5 years after the ending of a relationship. So the issue of how long you keep personal information is determined somewhere else. So maybe we are not as shell-shocked at the thought of this bill, but we need it for our international business relationships. So we're saying, hey, we've been arguing we need it. It's not a major showstopper. It's an international standard. We know all about FICA international standards. So maybe we have been there. In terms of the, I mean, costs, one of the challenges, and I'll go into more detail just now, but this is an enabling piece of legislation. And the lawyers are looking at it at the moment. Yes, the banks will be trying to estimate costs in their budgeting, their planning and forecasting. But in reality, there is no way anybody knows what this is going to cost. Because you have the enabling legislation, then we're going to have regulation. The new regulator will be involved in determining the implementation regulation and codes of conduct. So only once codes of conduct have been approved that you actually know the impact of this bill and its subordinate legislation. So until then, you don't know what it's going to cost. You can make assumptions. We can see how it works in other countries and on that basis. But until then, and a simple thing is opt-out, opt-in. Yes, you can determine opt-out for existing customers. But is the code going to require you to remeasure that or redetermine that every 3 years? That has a different cost implication to you stay opted out or opted in until you opt out. And those are the realities. So it's difficult to put a number. Maybe some examples from another aspect. FNB testified to the Competition Commission inquiry into certain banking practices, interbanking charges. It cost FNB 256 million rand for IT development on the National Credit Act. Not introducing the business, not training the officials. Purely IT costs, 256 million rand for that one piece of legislation. Yeah. And then Steve Boyson, when he was still chief executive of APSA before his current occupation of choice, said at one stage, they did an analysis of IT spend in APSA. 87% was on compliance. 13% was client-focused. And I think that's where the business context comes from the implication of the costs. I think two members. No, I think that was just the introduction while I'm getting into the text.
Okay,
So what we're saying is this is an international nexus and consensus around personal data privacy. And it's much as FICA. You really fit in or you don't play in that space. And that's where it's been driven. So increasingly we need this legislation and we're supporters of it. But it must comply with international standards because unless you do, the question is, sorry, you're not compliant. And examples of where this comes in, FICA identification, foreigners who are directors of South African companies, they are protected by their home legislation. Where there's cross-border businesses, wealth management, financial international trade and transactions, you need to have an equivalent personal information privacy. And then credit risk, integrated credit risk. A bank has a branch in the European Union in London or Frankfurt or wherever. The bank group has a centralized credit management policy. They cannot transfer data from the branch to the head office unless they comply. So that's a practical business model that we need to implement. Juristic persons, and that's the definition. There's been a lot of questions and debate. Every experience we have with legislation that includes juristic persons within the aspect of consumer protection, personal human rights, consumer protection extended to juristics is a problem. The one we have 5 years after implementation, we are still in argument with the regulator, is FICE, Financial Advisory Intermediary Services Act. We are still arguing about a merchant banking exemption. There is no evidence we have anywhere that Anglo-America requires a law to protect its rights. But the law says you have to comply with certain prescriptions designed for consumer protection. That's the problem we have when you start including juristics. The National Credit Act, the Consumer Protection Act, include juristics, but they cap them at a certain size. So you're restricting the protections to small entities, but that causes a compliance burden because you still have to build a whole regulatory compliance regime around a small entity which is different to a consumer. And the information flows around a legal entity are different to a consumer. And a simple example, a consumer's name, ID number, and address are private and can be abused. A company's name, identification number, and address is forced onto their documentation and letterheads. So there is a different perspective in dealing with them. It's been mentioned, the interpretation of the Act, all the definitions of personal information are personal, not corporate. How do you interpret the management of those? As I said, we have no indication from anywhere that large corporates actually want to be protected or pay for the costs that this burden will impose. A significant difference in interpretation is Section 69A. Which says that you may not implement cross-border information flows unless the other jurisdiction has substantially similar information protection rights. Now, where a country has no data protection rights for jurisdictions, one interpretation is, well, then there is no protection, so you are compliant. With all due respect, in the FICA space, if there is no equivalent FICA anti-money laundering, the law says you may not deal with that country. So there already is a legal precedent in this country that says if there is no statutory equivalence in that foreign jurisdiction, FICA, anti-money laundering, you may not deal with that country. If we include juristics and that clause 69A, you could effectively have a consequence of excluding the entire juristic cross-border information flow. And I'm not sure that that's what's intended. So our basic recommendation is to exclude juristics from the law. We've had a lot of discussion on the implementation and the times and why it requires time. And I think we must understand the rollout of the law. The legislation is enabling. It says you need to implement certain principles. It provides for a regulator, and then it says now do the rest of the legal framework. So, after the Act, we'll need regulations. The regulations must call for the regulator. The regulator must be established. I would assume the regulator will want to be involved in the implementation of regulations. Certainly, there's a role for the regulator in setting the parameters for the codes of conduct. Only once those codes of conduct have been agreed can the private sector actually start determining and implementing the bill in it or the Act in its totality. So it's a phased process that has to take certain steps. You can't overlap them. You can't do them in parallel. They have to follow a sequence. So our recommendation would be, and if we live within Section 103, at least 18 months for the state to put in a regulatory framework. Only then can the clock start ticking for the private sector to implement it. Now, again, an important debate around the time period is when does the clock start ticking? We have the Consumer Protection Act and the Companies Act. Currently, their clocks are ticking. They have been signed by the President, but neither Act has yet seen regulation published. Now, is the clock, the statutory period in the Act of 1 year or 18 months? How long do we have to wait for regulation before we can get in? So I think it's important in the debate, when do these periods start counting down, the 1 year or the 3 years? It has been mentioned as well, we need to know that waiting for the implementation of the Consumer Protection Act, and we're still waiting for the regs, the Companies Act, we're still waiting for the regs, and then what will possibly overlap is protection of personal information. These are all new, totally radical pieces of legislation with implementation consequences. They affect the entire economy, public and private sector, and really the question is, there's a limited amount of IT resources out there. And when everybody starts scrambling for them, they become a premium, and you can only do so much in so time. The government has to factor that in its consideration. Two of these are Department of Trade and Industry, and then the last one, obviously, is Justice. The regulator, the roles of the regulator, also discussed, Section 43. The key one is obviously regulator, supervisor, enforcer. That should be the role. The bill makes provision for the regulator to also be a consumer ombud, to investigate and adjudicate on individual complaints, as well as a review, and the Act is conflicted in its wording, as well as a review, or an appeal mechanism for the judgment of independent ombudsman. With due respect to the drafters, every ombuds we know of, the regulated constituencies are unhappy with them. They're either seen as pro-consumer or there are objections to their determinations. A regulator needs a special relationship with the parties that they regulate. And to create in the regulator also an ombudsman as a cheap alternative to the judicial process is going to put the regulator in conflict with the regulated institutions. In this case, there's a mass of regulated institutions. Most of them would probably ignore it if you look at other institutions, but it could be the big entities that would be in there. And it is unhealthy, in our view, and we're a regulated industry, if the regulator, the Register of Banks, are also to be the ombudsman. And that's why in the financial sector, there's a FICE regulator, there's a banking ombudsman, there's a credit information ombud, not the regulator. And we would seriously recommend that consideration be given to splitting that. What we haven't recommended, and the obvious alternative, is another structure, which would be an information ombud. But again, that's just another demand then on the fiscal purse, which is already under challenge. The question of opt-in and opt-out, Section 66, we believe has got a balance. It makes provision for existing customers to presume opt-in until they explicitly opt-out, and that we believe is a fair business solution. Then for non-customers, not clear in the Act, but it says you must determine whether they want to receive it. So by implication, and it's included in the memorandum, was included in the briefing to this committee, you're allowed one shot to non-customers to say, do you want to receive my information? And I think we must be careful in considering this. In the days of the Open Democracy Bill, where it was mostly junk mail, post-mailing, a 2% response rate, and it was a massively successful campaign. So there was debate about the 98% non-response. This bill talks about SMS, electronic, email, easy to respond. You click a button on your phone or you click a button on your computer and you respond yes or no. It's easier to respond to unsolicited electronic mail, than one shot, than it is to a letter where you have to fill in a form and actually post it back. So the response rate could be different, and we would support the current formation in the opt-in, opt-out provisions in that bill, but there will be a lot of debate around the opt-in. So quickly, some issues that we do discuss in our presentations, Chairman. This is an important regulator. There's a big role foreseen for it. Unless the state is going to adequately finance it, it's going to achieve very little, and it's going to be whinging and crying for money. And I think all the regulators and all the Section 9 companies are in exactly that position. So the automated decision-making, Section 68, has serious implications for the banking sector, but the devil will be in the detail, and that's where we would expect to engage with the drafters of the regulations, with the drafters of the code, because the banking system relies on automated decision-making tools. And the Law Commission report that referred to systems, risk management, credit management, where you actually want to depersonalize it. You want to take the people out of the decision to take out human bias. We mentioned cross-border flows. If legal, and we support the concept that in personal information, you can't engage in cross-border data flow unless there's a substantially similar protective environment, which is anti-money laundering, same concept. The challenge comes, as I've explained, when you have legal juristic entities and there is no equivalent regime. We understand there's 7 to 10 countries in the world that have legal juristic entities in their personal data privacy legislation. So effectively, most countries, there is no equivalent regime. If we were to include, we do make a proposal if jurisdictions are included in the bill. We make a proposal for an exemption in Section 69A that would cover this particular challenge. Section 94.1 refers to strict liability without intent or negligence. And we would argue that this is extending the existing statutory and common law practices in the country. We would argue that clause should be deleted and replaced with gross negligence or intent. We do not believe this is a bill where we should be introducing, as a concept in South Africa, strict liability. Finally, the bill makes provision in Section 94.3 for aggravated damages or penal damages beyond normal damages in Sections 3A and C. And we believe that subsection should be deleted. This should not be the bill to introduce this legal concept of penal damages into our jurisprudence. Finally, Mr. Chairman, in conclusion, this is principle-based legislation. It requires subsequent, in fact, three layers. Regulation, codes of conduct, then we'll know what we're actually dealing with. Jurisdictions preferably exclude, but we need to be aware of that substantially similar if they are included. Finally, we mentioned there's a sequencing of implementation before the private sector can actually even start. You can plan, you can budget, but the nitty-gritty, the detail can only take place once we know the final, and then we would seriously recommend that the regulator should not be a consumer advocate as well. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much, sir. Very clear presentation. Honorable sir.
Thank you. Just thank you for the input. Just briefly on the issue of costs, you said it's difficult to ascertain, but I think we do need a document or something. I think your colleague at the back did indicate some 200 million or something about costs, so we do need to get some further clarity on that. You can give us a document in due course within certain parameters as to the cost. Thanks. Well, my understanding from what you said about the costs was that it would be impossible to compute at this stage, given the fact that the code and the regulations aren't there. So that's my understanding of what you were saying, which was a bit in contradiction with what was said earlier. But I think just having raised that point, I mean, the regulations, the codes are then very important. At the moment, the regulations are just introduced by or tabled by the minister. There's no requirement, as is sometimes being put into legislation,
for parliamentary tabling or parliamentary approval. And I think the code, similarly, I think the regulator must consult, but they just come. Do you think there should be any provisions that provide for greater consultation, greater involvement in the codes and the regulations? Or do you think it's fine as it is?
We've been thinking of rewriting the section about the regulator to give it greater independence, to make it consonant with the way we deal with other independent regulators, given that this is, after all, someone must protect and give effect to one of the fundamental rights being in this privacy. Now, if we do that, one of the consequential amendments we might make is not to allow the minister to write the regulations, but require the regulator himself or herself to do so. So if you would just build that into your answer to Mr. Jeffries,
and if you
would like to comment on such a concept. We've heard you on splitting the functions of championing and adjudicating.
I think in the matter of cost, I can give you R1 billion now. Take one bank, multiply by four, and add the rest of the small banks, and you've got R1 billion. I think that would be a budgetary estimate. It would be what obviously one bank has built and factored into its 2-3-4 year budget process. But certainly, I can't say it's going to be less or more accurate than any other number. You've already had $750 million in one big life insurance company. Pick a number. It's like 18 months. Pick a number. If you give us 7 years, we'll implement in 7 years. If it comes to the regulations, normally the state government executive arm is responsible for drafting regulations. I know there are one or two statutes that require them to be tabled through the parliamentary process. I think that's a matter of executive versus the legislative arm. If it comes to who should make the regulations, you need to start with a set of regulations to create the regulator itself, the functioning of the regulator and the documentation and the forms, etc. Once the regulator is established, the regulator can then pass regulations dealing with the institutions they regulate. So I would say it has to be a two-phase process, because it would be short-sighted for the government, Department of Justice, to prepare implementation, what are the details and nitty-gritties, excluding the regulator, who then has to supervise and monitor. So my sense of it would be there would be a two-phase process, create the regulator, and then the regulator will make implementation guidelines as a process. But certainly, I think the champion on the protection of human rights should remain the Human Rights Commission, I think. The regulator is there to implement, make sure that industry obeys and complies. The reality, I think, with every other law is effectively your big 10% of the companies, that is 80% of the business activity will comply. And certainly in things like FICE, I think they're still trying to catch up the one man broker operations. So I think it's very much a 10-90%.
Thank you very much. The task has been made much easier. So we are at 1 o'clock almost. I suggest we break for lunch. And we can take the last 3 after lunch. I'm told that there is some food out there. We are invited to nibble. Or to the budget is the effort to
Please get clarity. We are meant to reconvene after the house at 3. Is that when we'll be reconvening? Okay.
Reconvening just after the house. We are meeting one time at 3. It means we'll be back here at 4.
Yeah.
Oh, actually, I'll be back here at 3.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you. We can leave the document there. Thank you.